Chapter 10. As the sweet little cherub who sits smiling aloft and keeps watch on life of poor Jack, commissioned to take charge of Mercantile Jack, as well as Jack of the National Navy? If not, who is? What is the cherub about, and what are we all about, when poor Mercantile Jack is having his brain slowly knocked out by penny weights, aboard the brig Beelzebub, or the bark Bowie knife, when he looks his last at that infernal craft, with the first officer's iron boot heel in his remaining eye, or with his dying body towed overboard in the ship's wake, while the cruel wounds in it do the multitudinous seas incarnate in? Is it unreasonable to entertain a belief that if, aboard the brig Beelzebub or the bark Bowie knife, the first officer did half the damage to cotton that he does to men, there would presently arise from both sides of the Atlantic so vociferous an invocation of the sweet little cherub who sits calculating aloft, keeping watch on the markets that pay, that such vigilant cherub would, with a winged sword, have that gallant officer's organ of destructiveness out of his head in the space of a flash of lightning? If it be unreasonable, then am I the most unreasonable of men, for I believe it with all my soul. This was my thought as I walked the dock quays at Liverpool, keeping watch on poor Mercantile Jack. Alas for me! I have long outgrown the state of sweet little cherub. But there I was, and there Mercantile Jack was, and very busy he was, and very cold he was. The snow yet lying in the frozen furrows of the land, and the northeast wind snipping off the tops of the little waves in the Mersey, and rolling them into hailstones to pelt him with. Mercantile Jack was hard at it, in the hard weather, as he mostly is in all weathers, poor Jack. He was girded to ship's masts and funnels of steamers, like a forester to a great oak, scraping and painting. He was lying out on yards, furling sails that tried to beat him off. He was dimly discernible up in a world of giant cobwebs, reefing and splicing. He was faintly audible down in holds, stowing and unshipping cargo. He was winding round and round at capstans melodious, monotonous, and drunk. He was of a diabolical aspect, with coaling for the antipodes. He was washing decks barefoot, with the breast of his red shirt open to the blast, though it was sharper than the knife in his leathern girdle. He was looking over bulwarks, all eyes and hair. He was standing by at the chute of the Cunard steamer, off tomorrow, as the stocks in trade of several butchers, poulterers, and fishmongers, poured down into the ice house. He was coming aboard of other vessels, with his kit in a tarpaulin bag, attended by plunderers to the very last moment of his shore-going existence. As though his senses, when released from the uproar of the elements, were under obligation to be confused by other turmoil, there was a rattling of wheels, a clattering of hoofs, a clashing of iron, a jolting of cotton and hides and casks and timber, an incessant deafening disturbance on the quays, that was the very madness of sound. And as, in the midst of it, he stood swaying about, with his hair, blown all manner of wild ways, rather crazedly taking leave of his plunderers, all the rigging in the docks was shrill in the wind, and every little steamer coming and going across the Mersey was sharp in its blowing off, and every buoy in the river bobbed spitefully up and down, as if there were a general taunting chorus of "Come along, Mercantile Jack." Ill-lodged, ill-fed, ill-used, hawkist, entrapped, anticipated, cleaned out. Come along, poor Mercantile Jack, and be tempest-tossed till you are drowned. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the uncommercial transaction which had brought me and Jack together, was this. I had entered the Liverpool police force, that I might have a look at the various unlawful traps which are every night set for Jack. As my term of service in that distinguished corps was short, and as my personal bias in the capacity of one of its members has ceased, no suspicion will attach to my evidence that it is an admirable force. Besides that it is composed, without favor, of the best men that can be picked, it is directed by an unusual intelligence. Its organization against fires, I take to be much better than the metropolitan system, and in all respects it tempers its remarkable vigilance with a still more remarkable discretion. Jack had knocked off work in the docks some hours, and I had taken, for purposes of identification, a photograph likeness of a thief. In the portrait room at our head police office, on the whole, he seemed rather complimented by the proceeding, and I had been on police parade, and the small hand of the clock was moving on to 10, when I took up my lantern to follow Mr. Superintendent to the traps that were set for Jack. And Mr. Superintendent I saw, as anybody might, a tall, well-looking, well-set-up man of a soldierly bearing, with a cavalry air, a good chest, and a resolute, but not by any means ungentle face. He carried in his hand a plain black walking stick of hard wood. And whenever, and wherever, at any after time of the night, he struck it on the pavement with a ringing sound, it instantly produced a whistle out of the darkness, and a policeman. To this remarkable stick, I refer an air of mystery and magic which pervaded the whole of my perquisition among the traps that were set for Jack. We began by diving into the obscurest streets and lanes of the port. Suddenly pausing in a flow of cheerful discourse, before a dead wall, apparently some 10 miles long, Mr. Superintendent struck upon the ground, and the wall opened and shot out, with military salute of hand to temple, two policemen not in the least surprised themselves, not in the least surprising Mr. Superintendent. All right, sharp eye? Apostrophe, apostrophe, all right, sir. Apostrophe, all right, tramp foot. Apostrophe, apostrophe, all right, sir. Apostrophe, is quicker there? Apostrophe, apostrophe, here am I, sir. Apostrophe, come with us. Apostrophe, yes, sir. Apostrophe, so, sharp I went before, and Mr. Superintendent and I went next, and tramp foot and quicker marched as rear guard. Sharp eye, I soon had occasion to remark, had a skillful and quite professional way of opening doors, touched latches delicately, as if they were keys of musical instruments, opened every door he touched, as if he were perfectly confident that there was stolen property behind it, instantly insinuated himself to prevent its being shut. Sharp eye opened several doors of traps that were set for Jack, but Jack did not happen to be in any of them. They were all such miserable places that really, Jack, if I were you, I would give them a wider berth. In every trap, somebody was sitting over a fire, waiting for Jack. Now, it was a crouching old woman, like the picture of the Norwood gypsy in the old sixpenny dream books. Now, it was a crimp of the male sex, in a checked shirt, and without a coat, reading a newspaper. Now, it was a man crimp and a woman crimp, who always introduced themselves as united in holy matrimony. Now, it was Jack's delight, his lovely Nan. But they were all waiting for Jack, and were all frightfully disappointed to see us. Who have you got upstairs here? Apostrophe, apostrophe, says sharp eye, generally, in the move-on tone. Nobody, sir, sure not a blessed soul. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Irish feminine reply. What do you mean by nobody? Didn't I hear a woman's step go upstairs when my hand was on the latch? Apostrophe, apostrophe, ah. Sure thin you're right, sir, I forgot her. 'Tis on Betsy White, sir. Ah. You know Betsy, sir. Come down, Betsy darlin', and say the gentleman. Apostrophe, generally, Betsy looks over the banisters, the steep staircases in the room, with a forcible expression in her protesting face, of an intention to compensate herself for the present trial by grinding Jack finer than usual when he does come. Generally, sharp eye turns to Mr. Superintendent, and says, as if the subjects of his remarks were waxwork, one of the worst, sir, this house is. This woman has been indicted 3 times. This man's a regular bad one likewise. His real name is Peg. gives himself out as Waterhouse. Apostrophe, never had such a name as Peg near me back, Finn, since I was in this house, be the good lord. Apostrophe, apostrophe, says the woman. Generally, the man says nothing at all, but becomes exceedingly round-shouldered, and pretends to read his paper with rapt attention. Generally, Sharp-Eye directs our observation with a look, to the prints and pictures that are invariably numerous on the walls. Always, Trampfoot and Quick-Ear are taking notice on the doorstep. In default of Sharp-Eye being acquainted with the exact individuality of any gentleman encountered, one of these two is sure to proclaim from the outer air, like a gruff specter, that Jackson is not Jackson, but knows himself to be Fogle, or that Canlon is Walker's brother, against whom there was not sufficient evidence, or that the man who says he never was at sea, since he was a boy, came ashore from a voyage last Thursday, or sails tomorrow morning. And that is a bad class of man, you see, apostrophe says Mr. Superintendent, when he got out into the dark again, and very difficult to deal with, who, when he has made this place too hot to hold him, enters himself for a voyage as steward or cook, and is out of knowledge for months, and then turns up again worse than ever. Apostrophe, when we had gone into many such houses, and had come out always leaving everybody relapsing into waiting for Jack, we started off to a singing house, where Jack was expected to muster strong. The vocalization was taking place in a long low room upstairs. At one end, an orchestra of two performers, and a small platform. Across the room, a series of open pews for Jack, with an aisle down the middle, at the other end a larger pew than the rest, entitled Snug, and reserved for mates and similar good company. About the room, some amazing coffee-colored pictures varnished an inch deep, and some stuffed creatures in cases, dotted among the audience, in sung and out of Snug, the professionals. Apostrophe among them, the celebrated comic favorite Mr. Banjo Bones, looking very hideous with his blackened face and limp sugar loaf hat. Beside him, sipping rum and water, Mrs. Banjo Bones, in her natural colors a little heightened. It was a Friday night, and Friday night was considered not a good night for Jack. At any rate, Jack did not show in very great force even here, though the house was one to which he much resorts, and where a good deal of money is taken. There was British Jack, a little maudlin and sleepy, lolling over his empty glass, as if he were trying to read his fortune at the bottom. There was Loafing Jack of the Stars and Stripes, rather an unpromising customer, with his long nose, lank cheek, high cheekbones, and nothing soft about him, but his cabbage leaf hat. There was Spanish Jack, with curls of black hair, rings in his ears, and a knife not far from his hand, if you got into trouble with him. There were Maltese Jack, and Jack of Sweden, and Jack the Finn, looming through the smoke of their pipes, and turning faces that looked as if they were carved out of dark wood, towards the young lady dancing the hornpipe, who found the platform so exceedingly small for it, that I had a nervous expectation of seeing her, in the backward steps, disappear through the window. Still, if all hands had been got together, they would not have more than half filled the room. Observe, however, said Mr. Licensed Victualler, the host, that it was Friday night, and, besides, it was getting on for 12, and Jack had gone aboard. A sharp and watchful man, Mr. Licensed Victualler, the host, with tight lips and a complete edition of Cocker's arithmetic in each eye, attended to his business himself. He said, always on the spot. When he heard of talent, trusted nobody's account of it, but went off by rail to see it. If true talent, engaged it. Pounds a week for talent, £4, £5. Banjo Bones was undoubted talent. Hear this instrument, that was going to play it was real talent. In truth it was very good. A kind of piano accordion. Played by a young girl of a delicate prettiness of face, figure, and dress, that made the audience look coarser. She sang to the instrument too. First, a song about village bells, and how they chimed. Then a song about how I went to sea, winding up with an imitation of the bagpipes, which Mercantile Jack seemed to understand much the best. A good girl, said Mr. Licensed Victualler. Kept herself select. Sat in snug, not listening to the blandishments of mates. Lived with mother. Father dead. Once a merchant well-to-do, but over-speculated himself. On delicate inquiry, as to salary paid for item of talent under consideration, Mr. Victualler's pounds dropped suddenly to shillings. Still, it was a very comfortable thing for a young person like that. You know, she only went on 6 times a night, and was only required to be there from 6 at night to 12. What was more conclusive was Mr. Victualler's assurance that he never allowed any language, and never suffered any disturbance. Apostrophe sharp I confirmed the statement, and the order that prevailed was the best proof of it that could have been cited. So, I came to the conclusion that poor Mercantile Jack might do, as I am afraid he does, much worse than trust himself to Mr. Victualler, and pass his evenings here. But we had not yet looked, Mr. Superintendent, said Trampfoot, receiving us in the street again with military salute for Dark Jack. True, Trampfoot. Bring the wonderful stick, rub the wonderful lantern, and cause the spirits of the stick and lantern to convey us to the darkies. There was no disappointment in the matter of Dark Jack. He was producible. The genius set us down in the little first floor of a little public house, and there, in a stiflingly close atmosphere, were Dark Jack, and Dark Jack's delight, his white unlovely Nan, sitting against the wall all around the room. More than that, Dark Jack's delight was the least unlovely Nan, both morally and physically, that I saw that night. As a fiddle and tambourine band were sitting among the company, Quick Ear suggested, why not strike up? Ah, lads! Apostrophe said a negro sitting by the door, give the Jeblum a dance. Tack ya pardlers, Jeblum, for quadrille. Apostrophe, this was the landlord, in a Greek cap, and a dress half Greek and half English. As master of the ceremonies, he called all the figures, and occasionally addressed himself parenthetically after this manner. When he was very loud, I used capitals. Now then. Hoy. 1. Right and left. Put a steam on, give bum powder. La dice jail. Balloon say. Lemonade. 2. A.D. warns, and go back, give belly breakdown, shake it out, oh yeah, soaps. Keep a marvel, swing corners, balloon say, and lemonade. Hoy. 3. Gent come forward with a lady and go back, hopper sight come forward, and do what the air can. Yayoy. Balloon say, and lead a lemonade. That air nigger by fireplace hind daytime, shake it out, oh yeah, soaps, give belly breakdown. Now then. Hoy. 4. Lemonade. Balloon say, and swing. 4 ladies meet in middle, 4 gents goes round ladies, 4 gents passes out under ladies' arms, swing, and lemonade till a moose can't play no more. Hoy, hoy. Apostrophe, the male dancers were all blacks, and one was an unusually powerful man of 6'3" or 6'4". The sound of their flat feet on the floor was as unlike the sound of white feet as their faces were unlike white faces. They toed and heeled, shuffled, double shuffled, covered the buckle, and beat the time out, rarely, dancing with a great show of teeth, and with a childish good-humored enjoyment that was very prepossessing. They generally kept together, these poor fellows, said Mr. Superintendent, because they were at a disadvantage singly, and liable to slights, in the neighboring streets. But, if I were Light Jack, I should be very slow to interfere oppressively with Dark Jack, for, whenever I have had to do with him, I have found him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.